Hello, everyone, and welcome to Here's to Your Health with Dr. Burns. I am Dr. Burns, and I have with me Tanisha. So how are you doing, Tanisha?
I'm wonderful, Dr. Burns. How are you?
I'm good. Now, the reason why we have you on is you have this extensive background and awareness for domestic violence, and because you've dealt with it, you had to deal with it. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what, through something so horrible that happened to you, what inspired you to actually write a book about it to let other people know?
Well, after surviving it, I was a firm believer that I had a story to tell, and I wanted to help so many other Tanisha Bagleys get out of their situation. And who better to show them than a person who has actually lived it, survived it. And so that's what I set out to do. And as a matter of fact, I just wanted to open facilities for battered women, men, and now I say, men and children, to help them get out of the situation. So in order to generate the funds to open these facilities, of course, you need money. And so I met with someone, and she was a small business planner, and she says, you have a story to tell. Why don't you put it on paper? And so that's actually where the book came about. I actually gave my first speech to the Raleigh Police Department, just share my story at their first domestic violence awareness program. And after that first 45-minute speech, I just knew this is what I was supposed to be doing. And so that's when I pursued, writing the book and trying to go ahead and generate the funds to open up these facilities. And in the process, it has taken me all over the country sharing the story, encouraging men, women, and children who are involved in any domestic violence situation to get out.
Nice. So now when you go in and because, you are a survivor and you are aware of all this, when you go in to talk to, a group, like the police or, to other, women, men, or children, what are some of the common threads that you see that someone needs to really look at in order for them to get out?
Well, the first thing they have to realize is to be safe. Think of a safety plan. Realize that this is a process. This is not something that you can just up and decide to do because your life and other people's lives are in danger. And, the end result a lot of times is death. And so what we talk about mainly is safety and, devising that plan to get out safely as possible and so that everyone comes out of this, in a positive light. But unfortunately, it doesn't always happen this way. And so that's the main focus when I'm talking with people. And, when they look at the flags and they see that the relationship is not going in a very positive or healthy direction, I give them all of the signs to kind of look for and things like that so they can recognize what type of relationship they're in. And whether it's good, it's bad, or not, they need to get out and get the help that they need so they can survive.
What are, for everyone who's out there, some people probably don't know, what are these signs that people are supposed to be looking for?
Well, there's so many, and because there's so many different aspects to domestic violence, no one situation is the same. Everyone is different, because it's not just physical. Most people think it's just a physical thing, and it may not be. It could be emotional or mental that a person is going through, and that's also classified as domestic violence. It could be financial. Someone's taking advantage of you financially. It could be sexual. It could be verbal. So because there are so many different aspects, there's so many different signs to look for. But, sometimes you just have to use that common sense and say, if things aren't going the way that you know they're supposed to go, if someone's controlling you, if someone's taking over your independence, if someone is saying, do this, do that, or, from a physical standpoint, they're beating you for the things that you do or you don't do. I mean, those are things that you need to look for and say, hey, this isn't right. And one of the major flags is if someone is trying to change you from being the person that you were. I mean, how can you say you fall in love with me or you want to be with me and you liked all of these things about me, but then we get together and now the first thing you want to do is change my hair or change my dress or change the way I talk or my friends or family. So those are some of the things you got to look for. But it really depends on what type of situation you're in. And you could be in more than one. So, mainly it's it's how someone is treating you. If you know that you're not being treated the way you know you deserve to be treated, then those are some of the signs for you to really say, hey, this is not right, and I might need to do something about it.
So then what now, it does take a lot of courage to be able to leave a situation like that. When did you have the opportunity to, like, find, like, a safe place for you to go, or was that not, like, an option for you with your situation?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that question because, you know, I stayed in my relationship for 11 years. It started when we were high school sweethearts, all through high school, into marriage, and three children after. And after I said, I had enough, I can't take this anymore, I reached out to the local domestic violence shelter, and, you know, they were full. They had nowhere for me to go. There was no space for me. And I was actually told if me and my children wanted to flee domestic violence, we would have to go sleep on church pews. And, you know, I was one, listen, I love the Lord like the next person, but I'm not taking my children out of their home, out of their beds to go sleep on church pews. And so I opted to stay in my abusive relationship for an additional year. And so I had the courage, and so I had the means, actually, not so much as the courage, because I had the courage a year prior, but to really build it up again and say, hey, I've got to get out of this situation. And so when I finally left, I mean, I left with the clothes on my back, literally, and that's how a lot of people in these situations do. And I was so fed up that I didn't care if I was sleeping in a car or sleeping on a park bench, that I was getting out of this situation. And so, unfortunately, at that particular moment, there wasn't any space for me, but, you know, that's the whole reason for, you know, letting the awareness be known and letting people know that we need more places for men, women, and children to go. You know, I live, and I'm not ashamed to say it, I live in Cary, North Carolina, and it seems like every other corner there's a cat clinic or animal hospital, and to me that's just pathetic when you only have one domestic violence shelter in each county, if that, to help people get out of these situations. And at that time, they only had an 18-bed facility. So now that's changed to maybe a 45-bed. I think it's a 45-bed facility, but that doesn't, you know, help at all when you have over 6,000 calls a year with women, men, whomever, trying to get out of these situations. So you do the math. There isn't a lot of help out there. You know, as far as, now take that back. There's help out there, but there's not enough. We can always use more. Let's just say that. That was my situation. That's what I ran into. And that was back in 1998. So you would hope now in 2013 things are a little better, but it can be better. It can get a whole lot better, I believe.
Now, I know that recently that Patrick Stewart, who's an actor, has actually come forward and has said that, you know, he's seen the domestic violence in his home, and he's actually asking men to stop, you know, with the domestic violence, because it's just not worth it. So have you, you know, been able to, I mean, because I know there's, like, some, you know, women out there who do it too. So it's not just men, you know, you're right. It's also, like, you know, women that do also have put on that domestic violence as well, to where the kids are the survivors of it too. And so what type of message, when you're going around, like, on, you know, like, newspaper interviews or in front of, you know, like, TV and stuff like that, what type of message do you try and get out there in order for this to stop?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because everybody thinks, you know, especially coming from a woman, oh, well, it's a woman's issue, or, you know, because of the name of the book, it's The Price of Love, so they think that I'm male bashing. And I say, no, listen, domestic violence does not discriminate. It doesn't care if you're male or female, black, white, yellow, purple, green, and it doesn't care what religion, what sex, what economic status. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And so my message is, even for women, I mean, to me, there's just as many women that are out here doing it than it is men. And it doesn't matter who's doing it. It just needs to stop. And so I love especially speaking to our men, especially to our young men, our young boys, because, you know, statistics will want to tell you that it's mainly men that are doing this. Okay, whatever. But I don't care who's doing it. We need to let them know that it needs to stop. And then also with women, I say, listen, you know, it's not right. And don't think, oh, well, you know, a man is not supposed to hit me. Yeah, he's not supposed to hit you, but you're not also supposed to do things such as, you know, I can hit him, but he can't hit me. That's not how it works. And so you have to look at the things that you're doing, too. You have to look at your actions, too. And when you look across the board, everybody needs to treat each other with the same respect, same level of decency, that we're not going to take it to this extreme. We're not going to get physical, and it's not something that you should do. And we're so quick to tell our men, you know, it's not appropriate to hit women, or our boys don't hit girls, that type of thing. It goes both ways. And when I tell you, I speak to those women, I speak to women just like I speak to men. And I said, if you're doing it, you need to stop, because you're going to go to prison just like they go to prison, and you should. There shouldn't be any leniency or anything like that because you're a female doing it. I mean, like I said, every situation is different. I understand that, and we have to treat it as such. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who's doing it. It's not right, and it needs to stop.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, so then what would you say then that those type of people who actually give the abuse kind of like look at the other person like an object, like they're not a person at all?
I mean, that may be. That may be in some cases it's a sign of possession. You know, you're my property. I mean, look at it. It's not just something that happens here in the States. Look at this all over from a nation standpoint. In some countries, a lot of countries, you know, women are property to their men. And they can kill. They have killed. They have tortured. They have done things. Their rule is what happens in your home stays in your home. So therefore, you know, you don't go to a court. You don't go get a domestic violence protective order and he goes off and taken out of the home or go off to prison or anything like that for the assault. So, you know, when you ask that question, it goes back to some people's mindset and how they're thinking, and that it's okay for me to treat someone that way, or they are my property. It just depends on their way of thinking. But I still, to me, that's like a blame game. I think that there are other issues that may be underlined that may lead to the domestic violence, but each one of these situations, or as I would put it, these problems are different things that could be and should be solved accordingly. So I don't like to play that blame game thing where, you know, that's just that person being, looking at them as not a true person or object, that okay. they're their possession. I don't look at it like that all the time.
Okay. So I know that it's like everything, and you're right, like everything varies, you're like per culture, per, you know, thing that's going on. So when you're doing these travels and you're, you know, needing, you know, like, and there are these different culture things, you know, do you find like different ways to be able to address it, you know, like per culture then?
I do. And it depends on who I'm speaking to. You know, there isn't an audience that I cannot address. If I'm speaking to young people, I tailor it to young people. And if I'm speaking to a group of Hispanics, then I'm going to tell it to, because it does, a lot of times it does go back to culture. Even if I'm speaking with African Americans, you know, a lot of times you may hear, oh, well, what goes on in our home stays in our home, or we don't discuss, or, you know, even in some other backgrounds, it is okay for the man to be that dominant. It is okay for them to be that submissive and allow the abuse to go on. You hear different things about different races and different backgrounds and different cultures. And so, be it that I know that, I do tailor my speeches or my training, depending upon who I'm speaking to kind of address it. But it still all goes back to home, where I'm letting them know that it's not right, regardless of your thinking, regardless of what your ancestors told you, or your parents, or your grandparents, whomever, what family members, culture, listen, it's not right, because at the end of the day, the end result is death, and that's, nobody deserves that. Nobody does. And so it all goes back to how you treat each other, and it's not acceptable. It's just not, and it shouldn't be, not in this day and age. And so, yes, I do tailor, depending upon who I'm speaking to, you know, and I'm very sensitive to their ways of thinking and their ways that they were brought up and how they accept certain things that maybe one person wouldn't or another culture would. But I still say at the end of the day, right is right and wrong is wrong. And this is what I'm trying to make you understand. That is not right for anyone to be in an abusive relationship, no matter what.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And so when, and so how are your kids doing, you know, like today, since you were able to get out of that situation, and I know you've raised them differently, do they have like a different outlook now because of, you know, what, because you're a survivor and because you're, you know, like this, you know, national speaker now out against it? I mean, how are your kids, you know, like looking at, at what you've accomplished?
Well, thanks for asking that question because it gives me a chance to brag on my babies. And I'm like, yay! I'm so proud of them. I am, first and foremost. And I am glad that I was able to give the strength to leave at the time that I did, because their ages at that time was 5 years old, 3 years old, and 9 months old. And so I still had a chance to, I had a chance to guide them differently. I had a chance to redirect their way of thinking, because they did witness a lot of the abuse also. Not so much as my 9 month old, but still the other two. And being that I think I left at the time that I did, with them being such an early age, and then now showing the positivity from then on, it has helped tremendously. I mean, my daughter, she'll be 20 in 2 weeks, my oldest. And then my boys, 18 and 15, and, they're going, one is in college already, one is getting ready to go off to college, and then I have my 15-year-old, and they are doing beautifully. And I must say, I don't do that pat-on-the-back type of thing, but I do say I'm so thankful that I got out when I did to show them things differently. And I don't sugarcoat anything when it comes to this topic, and especially with my children, because I place blame where blame belongs, and that's where the shamelessness comes from with me, because I'm ashamed of nothing. If I have done something wrong, or if I have wronged you, then I take full responsibility for that. But there's no way that I can take full responsibility for all the abuse that I've sustained. There's no way. And so when I realized that, and I took that out of the equation, it made it easy for me to share, and it made it easy for me to share with my children and let them know, listen, this is not your fault, this is not my fault, this is what your father chose to do. He had a choice in this, and even still after me and his split, he still is making those same choices. And so they see a lot of things for themselves, but I had to let them know, we're not going to play that blame game, and we're not going to use our situation as a crutch in life, because there are a lot of children out here who don't have one or either of their parents, and they're not going out here letting, things that have happened to them that could be worse than our situation, use that as a crutch to not do anything in life or just to fold. And that's just not how I raised them. And so I'm so thankful to say that by me leaving early, that is what truly helped them. And they know, and they're not ashamed either, and they're happy with the outcome. And that at the end of the day, we are helping so many people. I mean, they have traveled with me. They have gone to different places with me. They see me in action. They see the outcome. They have people coming up to them. They're like, wow, I see the positive in this, not the negative. And it's like a little family thing, and it's really been a great ride. And my children are doing amazing things. They're wonderful. So thank you for asking.
Sure. So no, that I think that's great. And so, so do you get more energy from that family support than say if you're going out, giving a talk on your own? It's whenever your children are there, do you feel more there's more spiritual or more energetic in wanting to get the message out because this is such a family, event for you?
Yeah, and I think where you're coming from is because it not just only affects me, but it affects them too. And I love it. You're right. I do. I get a little bit more giddy when they're in the audience, because at the end of that horrible story, I get to not only share and see people see, me and my outcome and how well I'm doing, but I'm able to introduce my children and say, hey, they're here too, and look at them, and look at what they're doing, and I get to brag on them and, the positive. And don't get me wrong, they're not perfect. Oh, goodness gracious, they're not perfect. But, there's a lot of the good outweighs the bad. And when people see that, they're like, wow, this is great. They can, that's why I said it's not just a me message. It's not just about me. It's about them, too. And because they're young people, they can relate to young people. And, that works out. And then I can, sort of hit the adult side of it, too. And so it all encompasses it, everything. It's not just about me being that woman, but it's that family. And then we speak about their dad and how this affects their father. And even today, and from a male standpoint, you have those men in the audience that are saying, man, is this me? And I've had that. I've had men say, man, I'm your husband. You describe me. And so it does help everyone in the audience, which I love. And so when I do bring them, it does help. And then even if I don't, you know, that's one of the first questions I always get is, how are the children? What's going on with the children? And so, you know, when they're there with me, it allows me not only to explain how they're doing, but to show them, too, how they're doing. And it's a beautiful thing.
Nice. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. Is there anything, any other message that you want to get out to our audience today?
You know, the main message is this. I live by the golden rule. Just treat people the way you want to be treated at all times. And if you do that, you won't be so caught up in all of the foolery of life. And that's the things that really don't matter. You know, and if there's an issue, I don't care what it is, not just so much as domestic violence, but it could be alcoholism, it could be drugs, it could be sex, it could be anything. What I say is just get the help that you need. We live in a country where there's help out there for you. And there's no more excuses. Just stop making excuses for things and go get the help that you need. But as far as the domestic violence situation, especially, you know, I say if you have children, mainly if children are involved, because they are the innocent ones in all of this. They didn't ask to be here. They didn't ask for this situation. And we, even though we don't want to be adults sometime, we need to step aside and be adults for those children and make better decisions so they can be happy and healthy. And I always say, you know, if you're in that situation and it's you by yourself, it's not really you by yourself. You still have family members, you still have friends, you still have coworkers, you still have people around you that can be affected by it just like you, and they are being affected by it. And innocent people die behind domestic violence every day, all day. We know that, we see that. You can turn on the TV and it's there. But what I say, if this is something you want to do, then you stick with that. It's unfortunate, but if you really want to stay in that relationship, seek the help that you and him, or him and you, whatever, him and him, I don't care who it is, get the help that you all need to be in a healthy relationship. Because no matter who it is, it's not healthy to be in any type of physical, mental, emotional, sexual, financial, any type of abusive relationship. It's just not healthy. And so I say just seek the help that you need to get better. That's my main point that I wanted to get across to everyone. And another thing, if you know someone who's being abused and you want to help, be that help. You can do it anonymously. You can do it in all types of ways. They don't even have to know you did it. You know, keep a log, keep a track, something. But just let them know that you're there for them. And don't turn your back, because maybe that one time that you turn your back, that may be the time that they really need you or they really need the help to get out, and you're not there. So those are some of the main points that I really want to put out there. But just know that it's not your fault. You're not the only one that's going through it. And I'd rather you take the steps to get the help that you need than to stay in something that you may end up dying. You may end up dying.
Right. Well, thank you so very much, Tanisha, for coming on our show and for putting word out there about domestic violence, because I know it's everywhere for everybody, and to have people be more aware of it. So thank you.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
All righty. And we're going for a short break. All right. Well, we're back from break, and I have my second guest with me today is Dr. Alan Hunter. How are you doing today?
Extremely Alan? Well, thank you. It's very good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, not a problem. I was I guess the request came up for you to be a guest on my show, and you intrigued me. You did.
That's good. I could say the same about you.
Because I read like a little synopsis about your book, Gratitude and Beyond, and yeah. I am just like the five insights to have a fulfilled life, and I'm like, ooh, this is going to be a good one. So for people who haven't read the book, what's your background and what motivated you to write this book?
Oh, well, I'll start with what motivated me, and that is with all my books, in fact, but especially this one, it came and sort of grabbed me by the throat and wouldn't let me go until I'd written it. So I usually take that as a good sign that there is something that needs to be expressed. But what I look at in the book is something that happened to me many years ago when I was living in England, which was that I became very ill and I nearly died. And I nearly died from a number of things, but one of them was an actual illness, a lung ailment, but it was made far worse by the psychosomatic element. In other words, the tension that I was putting myself under. And I start the book with this story of how I was basically suffocating, dying, and was then turned from death's door, fortunately, by a very good acupuncturist, even though at the time, all those years ago, acupuncture was thought of as being very strange. And the point about it is that my story is not necessarily dramatic in the same way that a near-death experience, such as we have read about, I'm sure, is dramatic, but it was just as important, because when we receive these major shocks, when we come close to dying, we have to ask ourselves some very important questions, such as, to what extent am I bringing this event onto myself? And what is it that I'm supposed to learn from it? And that, you see, is my definition of gratitude. If a disaster happens, we can shake our fist at the heavens and say, why me? Or we can look at the heavens and say, well, there's obviously something I have to learn here. What is it? And so it took me many years, over 20 years, before I began to realize the profound nature of gratitude and what lay beyond it, which is why it's called Gratitude and Beyond. And then I knew I had to write this book about the process of coming to terms with the things that I hadn't really looked at fully at the time. At the time, I had just been saying, oh, thank goodness, I'm alive. How nice is that? But there were deeper lessons that were waiting for me and wouldn't let me go. So that's the background to the book, and that's why I call it Gratitude and Beyond, and there are five things that I realized, which are the five insights.
Now, I like how you go through this book, and the part that I really related to, it's like not only do you go through like the gratitude aspect of it, but you also go through, basically the other pattern of like fear and selfishness and ugliness and pride. And so I like how you were able to balance those two out.
Oh, good, good. Yes, I think there are two directions we can go when a disaster strikes. And one is to realize that there is a lesson we can learn, usually a lesson that is centered on love, or we can go into the space of being frightened, in which case the only thing we teach ourselves is how to be more fearful. And so there is a positive way of looking at gratitude, and there's also a negative way in which we can refuse that gratitude. So I'm pleased you pointed that out. A lot of people don't realize there is a choice, and so they always go towards the negative.
Why do you think it is that we so easily go to the negative and not to the positive?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there may be two answers to that. I think one may be cultural, and that is we are so often encouraged by the news, etc., to look for what is negative and revel in it. And I think the other may be biological. Excuse me. I think perhaps when humanity was in its infancy, roaming on the Serengeti, what we were trained to do was to see what was wrong so that we could avoid trouble before it got too close. And unfortunately, we're still stuck with that. And so when an event happens to us, we're very likely to say, you know, oh, that was a bit of bad luck, and oh, I can't believe how that happened to me, and I didn't deserve that, rather than taking a more measured approach, which is to say, well, what just happened, and is there anything to be learned from it?
Now, do you find that trying to, like, learn something from it that people can get in and maybe, like, analyze too much of what just happened to them?
Yes, that is possible. But on the whole, I think people self-correct fairly quickly. I have a small counseling practice, which I do as well as being a professor of literature, and I found that when people mobilize gratitude, they can get, excuse me, a few times, they can take it a little too far, but usually they say, oh, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense. The difficulty is for many people is getting to gratitude, is to be reminded that there are good lessons that can come out of even difficult things. And that's what is referred to in the book as radical gratitude, when even a disaster can show us new and important things that we need to look at.
Now, I know that with this, you're saying that your near-death experience wasn't as dramatic as someone else's. Mm. Would you say that some people have, like, emotional near-death experiences instead of, like, a physical?
Well, what a good way to describe it. I mean, I think that does happen. I think many people have emotionally died at some point or shut themselves off from further living. I can think of the person who, at the age of 21, decided that she didn't want any more romance in her life and so lived alone for the next 40 years. I mean, that's a kind of emotional death from which she chose not to recover. So I think that's absolutely true. In terms of actual real near-death experiences, the statistics are a bit difficult to ascertain, but the most reliable one suggests that over 8 million Americans believe they have had real near-death experiences. That's a lot of people, and many of them are too shy to speak up about it. They fear they'll be ridiculed because their near-death experience doesn't seem to be extraordinary. So I think the emotional death is just as difficult to face as physical death, and we have the same choice, whether we're going to learn anything from it or whether we're going to just shut down and say, life is terrible, that's it.
So, and because the one thing that I got from the book is when people circle, and it seems like that seemed more of the emotional from that, with the experiences, we all seem to circle. And so can you tell us a little bit about what that circling is?
Yeah, circling is what we do when we're uncertain. And as its name suggests, it doesn't mean going straight to the thing that needs to be dealt with. It means moving around it. Now, this is very natural. If you don't know how to deal with a situation, you might want to move around it either physically or mentally and see the context. And that's good. But there comes a point when people continue to circle an issue rather than facing it. So imagine an everyday issue. You have a problem with somebody. Maybe it's your boss, maybe it's your neighbor, maybe it's a family member, maybe it's your spouse. And rather than saying, here's a problem, let's talk about it, maybe we can learn something, and that would be the positive way forward, what most people do is they say, well, this isn't quite the right time. And maybe after the weekend, or maybe after the in-laws have had their visit. And each time we do that, we make the situation just a little more complicated for ourselves, and we second-guess ourselves. In the book, I give my favorite example which is from Winnie the Pooh. And some of your listeners may know Winnie the Pooh when he goes looking for the Woozles. He's walking through fresh snow, and he sees some tracks. He doesn't realize they're his tracks, but he follows them, thinking, oh, this must be a Woozle. And then, because he's walking in a circle, he sees more tracks, and he thinks, oh, maybe there are two Woozles. And he walks further, and Piglet joins him, and they do another circuit, and they say, oh, there's two Woozles and a Wizzle. And they do another circuit, and Piglet gets really, really frightened and says that he's got to go home because there's something he's forgotten to do. And, you know, when I was 6 years old, I used to laugh at these silly creatures. Didn't they know they were just frightening themselves by looking at their own tracks in the snow? And when I reached 36 years old, I said, this is what we all do. We circle a problem, and each time we do that, we complicate it for ourselves. We blame ourselves, saying, why haven't I dealt with it yet? And it just gets more difficult. So circling is what we choose to do when we live in a place of fear. We don't move directly in a straight line to whatever it is that we need to deal with. And that's all too human and all too perilous.
Now, because I just read, I forgot what the article was. Someone did a research project stating that in naturally that we tend that we go in circles anyway. They drop some people off like in the desert, and they ask them to go in a straight direction to where the camp is. And a lot of these people naturally basically made a circle and came back to where they started from, even though they didn't know it. But without like those landmarks, you know, for them to go straight, they would just keep going in circles.
Fascinating, isn't it? So we actually have an inbuilt propensity to do this. Wow. I don't have no idea what the biological advantage of that could possibly be, but there must have been one once.
So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe that way we could find home again, you know, like some sort of homing beacon or something like that that's in us.
Perhaps it takes us back to the familiar, which is great if you want to get back to the familiar, but it's not much good if you want to make real progress.
Yes. So now, what are some landmarks then that you feel with the counseling that you do that help people be able to stay out of those circles?
Yes. Well, this is why I wrote the book. I think there are these five insights. And so the first of the insights is, of course, gratitude itself. When we realize that we have just been through something and we're still alive and we're still functioning, we can have a great sigh of relief and say, oh, whew, gosh, thank you, universe. Wow, fabulous. But that is just the beginning, because if we do that, we then logically have to go to the next point, which is the point that I call humility. And humility is not humiliation. Humility is when we look around and say, oh, I'm not as important as I thought I was. Or, let's phrase it slightly differently, the things that I thought were so important when I was rushing around before really aren't that important. Imagine, you know, the businessman who's driving too fast to get to his next sales call or whatever, and he wrecks his car. He has the choice as to curse his luck or to say, thank you, I'm still alive, and then, perhaps that sales call really wasn't as important as I thought it was. And once we're in that point, at that point, you see, something really important is happening to that rather strange thing called the ego. In fact, in the book, I call the different chapters in terms of what they are doing to the out-of-control ego, taming it, reducing it, coming to terms with it. When we take ourselves to a place of humility, we say, okay, there's more than just me and my little concerns. And when we get there, suddenly we realize something tremendously important, which is the third point. And the third point is, this is a beautiful world. It doesn't mean that everything is glamorous. It doesn't mean that every sunset is fantastic. It does mean there's real beauty to see in the world. And that That is absolutely vital. With my counseling clients, I find them looking around and saying, you know, there was beauty in that moment, even though it hurt like crazy at the time. There was beauty. We just couldn't appreciate it. And I could perhaps bring in my own experience with my mother when she was dying. When she was dying, there she was. She could not say what I would have liked her to say. And I couldn't seem to say the things that she wanted. And you may say that's very frustrating. And yet, there was beauty in that moment. Because even though we weren't able to do the Hollywood farewell, bedside, whatever, we knew there was love. We just couldn't find the right way to express it. Do you see what I mean when I talk about beauty in unexpected places?
Yes.
That's the third step. And when we see how beautiful our world is, even in difficult circumstances, when we see that, we are transported back to our authentic core selves, which I call the fourth step. I call that innocence. Innocence because just like children, little children, before they've learned to distrust, before they've learned all that other stuff, they are really good at loving and at trusting, giving and receiving that real love. And that's who we authentically are, all of us. But we forget it. We forget it because we think we have to be better than someone else. Think we have to prove something. No, we don't. We just have to love everybody else as much as we possibly can. And that fourth point is a real turning point because that's when we realize that all that ego stuff about getting ahead, making money, proving stuff, it really isn't the center of the discussion. That's the wounded ego. That's the part of us that craves reassurance. And once we can come to terms with that, we can put it aside and say, thank you very much. You know, we know you're there, but we're not going to follow what you're proposing. And when we do that, we look at our world and say, it's not about getting, it's about giving. And that's when I come to the fifth of the insights. And that insight is, so what is my place in nature? What am I here to do? Be it humble or exalted, doesn't matter. There's something that I can contribute. What is it? And so those are the five insights that I've found to be extremely helpful to some of my counseling clients. Not all of them can hear it. Sometimes people are too much in the grip of their despair to be able to hear that right away. But eventually they will hear it because it is the way out of that negative spiral that is focused on fear. So those are the five insights. And I think it's a question we all have to ask ourselves. What am I here to do? Not what am I here to get, but what am I here to give back?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It's, I mean, and that part, like, really resonated with me because those are, like, the exact same questions that I ask when my father died 2.5 years ago. I'm like, what was the point of those that are left behind? What are we supposed to be doing? What's the lesson that needed to be learned? You know, I mean, and that's the questions that I was asking, you know, like, of course, like, after going through the grief process. And that's when I saw, like, you know, like, with your book and just how, you know, I mean, and that's how it's supposed to be. Because through this journey, it's where it was finding all that, finding that we are here to help each other out. We are here to actually make this world better than when we leave it.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And it can be very hard to see that at the time. That's why I've called it a phrase that was created by Andrew Bienkowski. He called it radical gratitude. And sometimes, you know, there is a parent who is dying and we go through the grieving and then we realize there's a gift at the end of it. And it might not be quite the gift we expect, but it's usually a gift. Bienkowski, just to give you the background, he describes in his work, he describes how his grandfather I should say that they were Polish, and they were sent to Siberia at the outbreak of World War II. And his grandfather said, "Oh, there's not enough food for everybody, so I'm going to starve myself to death." Now, little Andrew, at the age of 5, he could have seen that as the most horrific thing and kept that image forever as the most terrifying thing. Instead of which, he said, "Yes, it was terrible, it was horrible. Grandfather died in front of me as they were sitting in the same railway boxcar for 2 weeks. He said, Grandpa died there, but I could see his love for me and my brother in what he did." And that's a real gift of love that you can take that through a lifetime, whereas the despair will destroy a lifetime.
So now then, how do people take what they've learned as adults to basically relearn how to be childlike, you know, with the innocence and stuff, and be able to bring that lesson that they've learned to, say, like, their children?
Yes. It's a difficult question because, of course, everybody's different and every family is different. But I can give you some general guidelines. I think that whenever parents practice gratitude and encourage others to think in terms of gratitude as often as they can, that we set in place a way of thinking that will defeat fear and will head off despair at the pass. And that's what we need to do. Our culture is very good at asking us to be afraid. They sell us lots of insurance and lots of things to protect our homes and safety devices for this. And, you know, they're very good at asking us to be fearful, but they're not very good at asking us to face the world with courage and with love. And I think if parents are grateful, children will be grateful back. And I hear this a great deal. You know, my child's so ungrateful, my child's so entitled, you know, all the kid thinks of is, you know, how much money he, she can get out of me. And I'm saying, okay, fine. What's missing here is gratitude. There is a sense of people being caught up in the swirl of the wounded ego that wants more and more stuff. Now, we can push back against that, and I think we are, as a civilization, we're beginning to push back against that by saying, let's be grateful for what we have, let's live more simply, let's get back to something that is more heart-centered. And this is the way that we outwit these forces that will otherwise put us in the place of wounded ego, where we just want more stuff because we don't feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, and then it's because I've noticed, like for my daughter, yeah, there are things that, I mean, I don't know, you know, I guess it's like natural for kids to have a competition. And so she'll tell me, like, "Oh, well, I'm the best runner in school," or something like that, "and everyone else isn't." And I kind of look at her and I'm just like, I'm like, "Do you really want to tell that to your friends?" I'm like, "You're not going to have any friends if you say that." I'm like, "It's okay for you to say that here at home, but I wouldn't say that in front of them." I go, "What?" I'm like, "What can you do?" And yeah. She's all, I'm like, "Well, why don't you say, hey, you know, it's like we all have fun running together." Uh-huh. You know, I'm like, "Just go ahead and tell them that." I said, "Hey, you know," I said, you can congratulate them. You can tell them that they've done a good job, even if they came in last. I'm like, "But you have to be in there and you have to give thanks to them because they are your friends." I'm like, "If you go around saying that you're, you know, like better than everybody else, you're not going to have any friends."
That's a beautiful example, isn't it? I mean, you know, children go to school and they're told to excel and be better. And of course, they do as they're told for the most part. And yet, you know, one child's good at running, your daughter's very good at running, but the thing to, for her to remember is that someone else is probably good at something else that she's not. So it's good to know what we're good at, but it's also extremely good that we know that that's not the sum total of what we are, because we need our friends too.
I'm just like, I mean, so I'm like, so whenever she'll say something to me, okay, I look at her, I'm like, are we supposed to be telling your friends that? She's all, no. You know, so she's in, you know, getting it from me. She says, I'm supposed to tell them you did a good job. And I'm like, yay! You know, like.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, children need to feel that they're good at something, or they're competent at something, and yet we have to walk the fine line between being obnoxious about what we're good at and thus alienating people. But you see, we need to know who we are. We need to know what our talents are. And so it's a double, it's a knife edge, isn't it? Which side you tip towards.
So definitely. And the thing is that it's so fine as to which side you tip towards.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, it takes a lifetime to try and get it right, and even then most of us don't, but that's what being alive is about, trying our best.
Yes, exactly. And I'm glad that it's a lifelong process and not something that, you know, people expect us to do in 30 minutes or so.
You know, isn't that the way, though? There are so many programs there that turn your life around in, you know, 2 hours or whatever. Well, that's great, but actually, it's like fitness. You have to keep turning up at the gym and walking that treadmill and lifting those weights your whole life. And the same thing with gratitude. You have to keep practicing it your whole life, and you will meet challenges. And you need to face them. We all need to face them squarely and do our best. So, yeah, it's a lifelong business. So we may as well get started as soon as possible.
Exactly. It's almost like if, you know, there's a joke that went out there. It says, Lord, give me patience and I want it right now.
Right now.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Well, okay, well, we're about ready to close with our program here. Is there anything that you'd like to say?
Well, I'd like to say that this is not my only book. This is one of 11 that I've written, but the last 7, I think, are probably the most spiritually based. And my website is allanhunter.net. That's A-L-L-A-N hunter.net. .com is somebody completely different in Australia. And my website, amazon.com, will have the first chapter of all of my books for you to read and get a flavor of. Gratitude is just my most recent book. So I hope that there will be other possibilities for further reading.
All right, sounds good. So it seems like there's probably almost like a year's worth then of reading there if you take one book a month.
Well, I think there's a good chunk of reading worth assimilating there. That's why I wrote them, because they came to me saying it's time to write this now, and people seem to really get something from them, for which I'm grateful too.
So thank you very much. For coming on our show. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure. And you've been a delightful person to speak with, because I think we're talking the same language about this, aren't we?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yes. So we'll have to keep in touch.
Please. Yes, I'd like that. And thank you again for allowing me this time. And thank you for all you do for all your listeners.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you to everyone for listening in, and we'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.